Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to Exploring the Lord of the Rings. This is session number 292 tonight. And tonight, it is time for Mordor, of course. that is, more of the Doors of Moria. So, quick announcement, quick reminder. We have the second of our spring moots coming up. This weekend. So this weekend I will be in Orlando, Florida for Sunshine Moot. Still time to join us there. Not actually in Orlando, but near Orlando. You can join us for Sunshine Moot, and of course you can do that remotely as well. So Sunshine Moot, always a great time. We're going to be talking about poetry and songs this year, so much fun to be had there for sure. Tonight, I'm going to start with something that we were discussing. One of the reasons that if you're here in real time, I'm late beginning, is that we have a couple things that some folks were sharing that they were looking at and thinking about since our last discussion, and I wanted to share those. So first, McBjorning Face has found this reference. So one of the things that is clear, we were talking about the drawing on the door last time as an adaptation, right? And of course, we know that Tolkien drew the door illustration, but the one that's in the published book is not the one that he drew. It's one that is drawn closely based on his drawings. So the reference that Bjorning found in the new edition of the letters from letter 140C here's him critiquing it, right? Drawing of the door. I did not understand for chapter four of book two. I did not understand that blocks were to be made forthwith from the sketches and was awaiting some note indicating preferences or queries for technical reasons. This, by the way, is the kind of thing that often happened with Tolkien and the publishers, where there was often poor communication about what was going to happen, right? Where he would, so like when he said, I did not understand that blocks were to be made forthwith from the sketches. So he sent sketches, right? And he was awaiting some note indicating preferences or queries for technical reasons. Like, he was making these suggestions, right? And was expecting some feedback, presumably then so that he could make, you know, new and perfected ones, right? But instead of providing him feedback on the sketches that they gave him, they just took the sketches that he gave them, and without any further discussion, they were like, "This'll work," and so they made the drawings based on those sketches. That is my understanding of what he's complaining about there. Otherwise, I should have said at once that only the inscription on version B was correct, and given such helps and explanations for the copier as I now enclose, and the other enclosures are especially objecting to italic fonts and things like that. To copy a rather scratchy inscription without knowing the purport or the normal forms of the individual letters was asking too much. I am afraid that this will have to be done again. When this is done, I agree to the alteration of the original sketches, making the outer arms of the trees curve outside the pillars, but the third major leaf curve on the right-hand tree needs refining. The inscription and the explanatory matter at the bottom, now in script italics, will need rewriting. One of the things that I would draw attention to based on what we were discussing last time. Remember that when we were looking at the drawing, and I was talking about how, when it was in the Moria discussion last week, right? One of his purposes for this was to give a kind of Rosetta Stone, right? A way for interested readers to learn Tengwar, to learn the Elvish language, right? I mean, you know, he wanted that. And so you'll notice his emphasis. He does talk about the drawing to some extent, right? He's interested in the art, but he's much more interested in the text, right? That they get the text right. The explanatory text is super important to him, right? And so that's why he was harsh about the fact that he what he sent was not meant to be final. And if it had been meant to be final, he would have had much more than just sketchings. That was really important to him. But anyway, the point is, we were discussing, as Bjorning was saying before, we were discussing this, the drawing, as an adaptation of the text. And the point is, we learn from this that it's not exclusively his adaptation, that there was another artist at work here who added some touches of their own. Clearly, the curving of the branches around the column was the innovation that he refers to. So if we go back, if we go back, here's one of his earlier sketches. Now keep in mind, I don't know, Maureen, unless you have found any references here. This sketch can be found in The Art of the Lord of the Rings, edited by Hammond and Skull. And this is one of his sketches of this pre-publication, right? I don't know that this is like exactly the sketch that he sent to them. But it is one of his earlier sketches. So there are a couple things that I would point out here. So one is, we can see one of the major differences, those trees, right? The way that the trees, so the difference that he points to in this letter is that he did not make the trees to be embracing the pillars in that way, but he didn't object to it. He's like, that's fine. You can keep that, right? I'm not sure about the leaf curve on the right-hand tree needs refining. I'm not sure which, maybe it's been fixed or something. It looks pretty symmetrical to me. I'm not sure if there were leaf sketches. I don't know. I'm not sure. Yeah, maybe they were asymmetrical. It's possible. I mean, it is true that we can see his attention to symmetry. It's interesting, isn't it? Because the trees themselves are asymmetrical. That is, each individual tree is asymmetrical. They're balanced, but asymmetrical. But the trees collectively are symmetrical with each other, right? And that's interesting. But so yes, maybe that was sort of part of the issue. One of the reasons I doubt. So I have doubts about the crown, Durin's crown up here. One of the reasons that I would be surprised if this crown, the crown in his sketch, which, to be perfectly frank, looks rather like a jester's hat with bells on, and then you see the helmed crown, right, that we see here. The one in the published version looks so much like helmets that Tolkien has sketched in other places, of like, you know, a helmet with a crown around the base, like this sort of domed helmet with a crown around the base. That strikes me as such a typical Tolkien design. It would be an odd adaptation, right? If we go back to the text, I gotta go way back to the text. All it says, an anvil and a hammer surmounted by a crown with seven stars. Surmounted by a crown with seven stars. That the illustrator, right, that the Allen and Unwin illustrator, who is making the final version here, would take the step from the text there without any authority from Tolkien's sketches and say, you know what? I think this crown should be a helmet crown. Like I am not at all sure. That just doesn't make sense to me. It's kind of like the kind of mistakes you sort of expect a scribe to make. Like, scribes do make errors. But there are some errors that are more common, some kinds of errors that are more common than other kinds of errors, right? I can't imagine that the Allen and Unwin illustrator all by himself was like, yeah, I'm going to turn this crown, which is just called a crown, into a helmet, right? So if Tolkien had actually given them this sketch without the helmet inside the crown, right, I cannot imagine how it could possibly have ended up with a helmet. I just, that's really odd, right? That would be really odd. Again, Tolkien drew, especially in a Gondorian context, right? You can look at his sketches for the helmets of the, you know, the Citadel guards in Minas Tirith, which look rather like they were designed for the Conehead family from Saturday Night Live. But nevertheless, they look quite a bit like the crowned helm that we get in the final illustration here. Anyway, my point is, I don't think that this sketch is the only thing that Allen and Unwin were working from when they moved from Tolkien's sketch to this final version. But one of the touches that we were discussing last time, when we were discussing this as an adaptation of the text, rather than merely as, you know, a sort of an attempt to represent what the text says, are the columns. And the columns are there in Tolkien's illustrations, in Tolkien's sketches, in multiple of Tolkien's sketches. His, like, artistic eye seemed to have pictured columns holding an arch like a proper gateway, right, from pretty much the beginning, right, even though it's not how he describes it in the text, right? Or perhaps, to say it another way, when he's describing it in the text, if this was the picture he had in his mind, it's not a picture that he felt, it's not an element of the picture that he felt of sufficiently, of sufficiently great significance to include in the description. Another thing I would say is, if you look at the trees, remember the trees bearing crescent moons, right? One of the things that interests me is that in both of the early sketches that are included in the art of The Lord of the Rings, there are moons above the trees, which is what the words raise in my mind right away. That is, bearing the moon, meaning holding up the moon, right? However, between the first and the second versions of the sketches, he does include, these are bearing the moons like fruits, right? Like the moons are leaves. It's bearing them in that different sense. These trees are doing both. They're both supporting a moon on top, and they're also bearing them in the sense of moon, crescent moons are growing from them, right? Those moons are no longer here. Again, I can't help but think that the sketch that they're actually working from probably doesn't include that. This looks to me, if you put the three of them next to each other, that is the original one, and I didn't include it, sorry. I didn't include the original one, just the second one here. The one that's more like the final one. The early sketch just has like two bushes with the moons up above. There seems to be a kind of an evolution of the idea, right? From just like bushy trees with a moon above them to trees with crescent moon leaves that still have moons above them, And then in the final, just the crescent leaves and no moons above them at all. And again, that's another detail that I would not expect the illustrator to just kind of make that call. And I certainly would not expect Tolkien not to call them on it if they had, right? I think it's likely that the sketch that he sent them did not have the moons above, as in his own mind, the idea of the moons, like the ideas of the trees and the moons was in some sense evolving, right, in his own mind. And this does seem to be the direction into which, you know, the direction in which it was evolving. Björning, this is hard again because I don't know what sketches we have, right? It is true that in the earlier sketch, the seven stars are surrounding the crown, right? Whereas in the published version, they're in an arc or really, you know, a sort of pyramid, right, above the crown. But I think, once more, I am not certain that I am ready to say that was a matter of the artist simply taking liberties with it. Aha! Yes, there it is. Okay. All right, hang on. Thank you, Maureen. Maureen is helping me with something here. Hang on. I'm just going to do this quickly. This is going to be a little rough and dirty, but we'll see what we can do. Okay, hang on. Sorry, I gotta get it off my desktop now. Gotta find my screenshot. Okay, here it is. All right. There we go. We could probably do better, but so these are the different versions that you can kind of see here. There we go. Yes. So this is the sketch that he said. And so as you can see, I was correct, right? He's changed. This is the one we were looking at, the intermediate sketch, the revised drawing. This is the one, the top left is the one I was describing before with what look like little bushes with moons above them, right? And the final one does have those features that it does do the helmed crown, like I was certain it must do. That again, the publishers weren't going to make that up. And so you see that actually the idea of the branches of the tree going around the column was Tolkien's idea. He just had them going behind the column instead of in front. So it isn't a question of them breaking the frame. That was the innovation. The innovation was them going curling in front of the columns instead of behind the columns, which is rather interesting, actually. You know what that suggests to me, actually? And I don't know, I might be wrong. I agree. So Rin says the curling in front of the tree is definitely a design improvement. In front of the column is a design improvement as it breaks up that blank space in the columns. I agree it's more attractive, but you know what it does is it changes the perspective. It changes the perspective. So when you look at this, at Tolkien's sketch with the branches of the trees behind the columns, how are you seeing this? Do you see? The gates are in front. The gates are in front of the trees. It's like you're seeing from out the gates, right? There's the gates, the frame, like the pillars and arch of the gates. And then on the other side of the gate are the trees. And then presumably, like, the column, the row of trees, right? The avenue of trees continuing down. So, yeah, I think that the original view, just based on what he's showing, with the roots are clearly behind the pillars, and the branches are behind the pillars in Tolkien's drawing, right? And so that suggests that the drawing is drawn as if looking out, which is weird because it's on the outside. Like, in order to see this drawing, right, in Ithildien, right, you would have to be standing out looking in, right? And yet it creates the depth that it does create suggests to me that it's evoking a view from inside looking out. Whereas the final one doesn't do that. And I think it's, I don't know how much the artist was thinking about that, or if they were just thinking, Rin, as you were suggesting, that the breaking up the columns, you know, the white space of the columns looks prettier, which it does. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the motivation of the artist was there. Narvi did make the gates, but it's Celebrimbor who made this picture, right? What we've been discussing here this whole time is the work of Celebrimbor, right? So, Rin, I agree with you. I agree with you that with the roots still being, like, you can still see the trunks go down behind the base of the pillars. So the trees are still on the other side of the pillars. The effect that's created is the trees, like, moving towards you, right? Like, entwining in, like they're coming sort of inside the gates, right? Thanks, Bjorning. Kal Elros is right. When you think of, when you look at it from the perspective of Tolkien's drawing, that is, with the, as if you were looking out, the Star of Feanor now could represent Os Dinethil itself, right? That is, if we imagine the pillars and then the two trees on the other side of the pillars, right? And then the avenue of trees beyond, where does it lead, right? The path away from these doors of Moria, where does it eventually get? Not in a straight line, but conceptually, where does it go? It goes to, you know, to Eregion, right? It goes to Os Dinethil. It goes to the city of the Feanorians. So that is interesting, conceptually speaking. That is interesting. And you can see in all of Tolkien's drawings, the Star of Feanor is always there. Sometimes a little bit lower in the first. Well, no, because in the first one, he's only showing the bottom, like, stubs of the pillars, or the top stubs of the pillars, really. Anyway, this Star of Feanor is always in the middle there. Interesting. Cool. It's the heart of Feanordom on Earth. Well, in the Second Age, anyway. Yeah, exactly. Justin, I agree. There are lots of fun ways in which the intertwining of the trees around the columns works, right? I don't know exactly what Tolkien was thinking when he said that he's okay with it, right? But certainly there's a lot to like about it, isn't there? I also like the idea of the trees of the High Elves entwining around the columns of the gates of Moria is itself like a symbolic of the relationship, as you say, Justin, between the elves and the dwarves. I like that. I like that a lot. And Leaf of Starlight, I agree. Tolkien, the artist, could probably see it worked better compositionally, too. Yes, yes. Cool. All right, so there's more we could say about this here, but that was... that would be... One other thing. The stars. We're talking about the stars. And we can see that Tolkien did arrange them more or less. Like, again, it's not an innovation of the publisher to... so as I suspected, the publisher, the artist of the publishers, right? The professional illustrator did not do very many massive innovations, right? It's very close to what Tolkien had here. Oh, I see the tree on the right-hand side that he was concerned about. It's not even done in Tolkien's original sketch. So I bet you in the first version, they reproduced that faithfully and made the bottom branch of the right-hand tree all stumpy. Right? And Tolkien was like, yeah, again, like that was just a sketch. I didn't mean that. Right? But anyway, one thing that is noticeable to me, though, that I think they did change a bit, at least, is the angle, right? The kind of triangular, like strict wedge shape of the stars feels a little bit odd. And you can see that Tolkien seems to have arced them more. Even they're asymmetrical in Tolkien's sketch. Maybe that was a mistake. And he meant for them to be symmetrical. Possibly. But I think it's likelier that Tolkien this is a constellation we're talking about. This is not a design on a flag, right? This is supposed to represent a constellation. Yeah, I don't know. And Leaf of Star, I don't know. It's easy for me to say, right? I understand that it's hard to draw stuff like that symmetrically. Yes, yes. Exactly. So yeah, it is hard to conclude whether or not that's a mistake by Tolkien, like the stumpy branch on the right-hand side was a mistake. See, notice how even let's be honest, the anvil is a little weird, right? I mean, like, the one that Tolkien drew in this sketch, it's odd. Like, that's a weird anvil that he made. And the professional illustrator is just like, okay, whatever you say, dude. Like, even the asymmetrical little weird pointy bit, you know, on the right hand side is retained faithfully, right, from the earlier version there. Anyway, it also, do you think the letter D that we were puzzling about down here, do you think that D, some people are saying it looks like it was erased on the sketch, but I don't know. It's the same exact state of fadedness as the initials on the top. This text. No, I don't even think. Oh, the thing that you can faintly see right below the star? Oh, yeah, no. Honestly, that looks to me like something from another sheet of paper, honestly. or maybe from like writing on the backside of this piece of paper or something like that. That doesn't look like something that was put in there at all, honestly. Yeah, I think that's what's kind of centered, but it's also kind of crooked. Like it's not even it's kind of tilted, you know, like I'm not, maybe it's possible. I don't think so. Yeah, Eric, you're right. If there are curls in there, the curls are going in the wrong direction. Now that could argue that the elf who did those was left-handed, right? But still, I don't make too much of that. Anyway, okay, all right. The asymmetrical, like the off-centeredness of the D down here at the bottom there is in the original, but the final one is more asymmetrical than Tolkien's one is. Yeah, praise, I agree. The curls going in the other direction suggests to me too that what we're seeing is something coming through from the backside of the page. Yeah, I think so. And no, I don't think Arnas, sorry, I don't think Celebrimbor is left-handed, at least not based on the rest of the Tengwar. You can always tell a left-handed elf, right? They curls, the curls of Tengwar always use the right-hand rule with your thumb pointing in towards the page, right? So if you're right-handed, you do your curls always this way. Even the curls that go the other direction go this way, right? With your thumb pointing in. You always use the right-hand rule in both directions to do your curls in Tengwar with your thumb pointing into the page. But a lefty elf, a left-handed elf, uses the left-hand rule. So their curls are backwards. That's how it works. That is the explanation for that kind of confusing passage. You may remember this is in the Nature of Middle-earth. We talked about this passage in the Mythgard Academy discussion we did of the Nature of Middle-earth. And it was a pretty confusing passage to try to follow. I understand it much better since I learned to write Tengwar. But anyway, okay. Yes, I agree. I think you can see the outline. So Trifle is talking about how you can see if it's lettering on the backside of the paper, it looks like we can see more stuff up here. I agree. I think we can see there's a whole other thing on the back of this page. Keep in mind, Tolkien, this was during paper rationing still. So even something, I mean, if you're wondering like why on earth would Tolkien, you know, make a sketch, like a drawing that he was meaning to send the publishers, you know, on the back of something that was bleeding through onto the paper. Because there was paper rationing. Like paper was really, really precious. He was still using the backs of all sorts of things, right, to do all of his stuff. Okay, that is a fascinating theory. Let's see. Sorry, I lost the theory. Oh yeah, Trifle was suggesting it's possible that the other side could be Balin's tomb inscription. I like that theory. You can see the square lines. Yeah. Doing a forensic analysis of this sketch to try to figure out what actually is written on the other side. is perhaps a little beyond the limits of what we can accomplish here. But possibly. Possibly. Yes. And yes, left-handedness was totally a thing among elves. And they would have written, is in the passage JJ was just quoting, they would have written from the right to the left-hand side of the page. Lefties would as well. But the cool thing is, even doing it that way, you can still follow it. Because Tengwar is so cool. But anyway. Anyway, yeah, there it was. Okay. So thank you for the further digressions here this evening. Let's go back to the text and finish this slide. I think it counts as two slides because we're finishing the one that has the picture on it too. all right. Anyway. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, yes, sorry. Okay. Yes. I'll answer that question. Vardendil. Yes, you are correct. Hang on. Where'd it go? The isolated letters in the mode of Beleriand. That's a C, that's an N, and that's a D. So you've got Celebrimbor, Narvi, you know, doodling their initials in the top corners. And then you've got D, presumably for Durin, at the bottom. Yeah. Yes. Yes. D is for door. Yes. Exactly. So, Everett, I think that's a really interesting question. Why is this the only illustration in all of The Lord of the Rings? Could Tolkien have included more? Yes. Sure. He could have included more. Especially since we know he made more. I mean, his own... As a visual artist... He was frequently picturing things and like doodling pictures of them in the margins. Yeah, he did want to include the Book of Mazarbul. Absolutely. And clearly went to some pains to prepare the book. But unfortunately, it's sad because clearly in any kind of modern publication, it would have been easy to include the Book of Mazarbul, the beautiful, burned and textured, drawings that he did of the Book of Mazarbul. If you've never seen these, and they're gorgeous to see in person, but if you've never seen an image of them, Google that. You know, Google Tolkien's Book of Mazarbul images, and you'll see what he drew is really cool. But it was equally clear that the publisher couldn't do it. Thank you, Penloth, was just posting that. That's the final page. You can see the shift in runes. Here, I'll just show it quick here. We'll come back to this when we get to the Book of Mazarbul. But just so that you can see it briefly. No, that's not what I meant to do. Hang on. Darn it. 1 second. Having technical issues. Okay. Drat. Urgh. Okay. Where did that even go? Never mind. Never mind. I'll show you later when we get there. We'll get there. We're going to get to the Book of Mazarbul in less than 3 years. Come now. Come now. never mind. Book of Mazarbul later on. Okay. Okay. Back to the text. Back to the text. Here's a slide we didn't finish last time, which we're practically done with. "There are the emblems of Durin," cried Gimli, "And there is the tree of the High Elves," said Legolas. "And the star of the House of Feanor," said Gandalf. "They are wrought of Ithildine, that mirrors only starlight and moonlight, and sleeps until it is touched by one who speaks words now long forgotten in Middle-earth. It is long since I heard them, and I thought deeply before I could recall them to my mind." Now let's pause for a second here. This is one of the things that we didn't get back to that I was hoping to get back to last time. One of the things that I think is, so Gandalf is going to, soon, he is going to be laughing about how much simpler, you know, the entrance riddle is than he had assumed, right? The answer to the riddle is too simple for a learned lore master in these suspicious times. But that can create, I think, perhaps a misunderstanding. These doors, I don't think are trivial to enter at all. The Ithildine is not... Oh, so, yes, it says right on the gate the word... I mean, the password isn't quite password, but it's right there, right? But it's only right there if you can see it. And Ithildine mirrors only starlight and moonlight and sleeps until it is touched by one who speaks words now long forgotten in Middle-earth. So if you don't know the words to reveal it, and it's, noontime, you're out of luck. You're not going to be able to reveal this. So, yes, there is, I think. So this is the question, Bjorning, that I think is important here. Ithildine was not revealed by a secret phrase, but rather by a colloquial once known by many phrase. That's exactly what is to me unclear. Now, that the words have been long forgotten in Middle-earth, okay, maybe it was widely known. Everybody knew them, right, back in the day, right? It was the commonest thing in the world. It still doesn't change the fact that most of the time, and in fact, even... not just during all daylight hours, but even during most nights, or many nights. I mean, if it's cloudy, right? You're not going to be able to wake up the Ithildine. And so if you don't already know the password, even if you do, even if the phrase is even bit more widely known than the password itself, it's still not going to be a whole lot of help, right? So yes, Leaf of Starlight, I do think people who come to the gate knowing the word, right, they wouldn't be revealing the Ithildine. They wouldn't bother with it, right? They would just come up and say Melon to the blank wall, and the blank wall would open, right? Presumably is how that would work. And I am not convinced. At least, I do not think it is inevitable to conclude that the words which are now long forgotten in Middle-earth used to be known by everybody. Gandalf's phrasing, sleeps until it is touched by one who speaks words, now long forgotten in Middle-earth. It is long since I heard them, and I thought deeply before I could recall them to my mind. Yeah, exactly, Arnas. It's like it's the two-factor authentication on the forgot my password feature. Yeah, exactly. That's more or less what it is. So yes, I do believe he is saying that if the doors are closed, only those with knowledge of the secret words of Ithildine could see the instructions. Yes. Yes. Again, it all depends on how secret were the words that Gandalf just spoke. But again, if we go backwards, which means going forwards, He walked forward to the wall. Right between the shadow of the trees, there was a smooth space. And he passed his hands to and fro, muttering words under his breath. This is not a single word passphrase that he says. Right? He says this whole thing while passing his hands to and fro. We don't know what he says, but it's more than just a single word, for sure. Right? Is what he is saying some kind of spell? Right? Is it some kind of command or instruction that the Ithildien is designed to respond to? I don't know. Valoria says, friend is the captcha after the password. Something like that. In other words, the point that I would make is that it seems to me, I think that there are two reasons to believe that these doors are designed with security. Security is part of the concept of these doors. The phrase that Gandalf says, which again, maybe was known by everybody. Maybe it's just, who knows? That's one reason. The other reason is the way that Gimli refers to them. Gimli, remember what Gimli calls the doors when they're approaching, the walls? If Gandalf can find the doors that are shut, that's very interesting to me. That has all of the resonance of that's what these doors were called, the doors that were shut. Now it may be trifle as you were suggesting before, right? It may be a reference to the shutting of the doors of Moria. You know, when Eregion falls and Sauron comes north, right? And so it's a reference not to the doors themselves, but to like that historical moment, right? Anyway, I am. Gimli's uncertainty. Gimli does not take it for granted that Gandalf will succeed in finding the doors that are shut. There seems to be, and again, that name implies to me that hiddenness, that security is a feature of these doors, is part of the whole dwarvish conception of these doors. The dwarves don't mean this to be a constantly open highway into their realm. They do mean to allow their friends and allies, the elves of Eregion, to be able to come and go. And so they install this password system, which is a very friendly password system. But it's still a password system. It's not just something that anybody could waltz up and do get through, you know, by accident. So anyway, I think that it is, I would be cautious about viewing these as like a totally unsecure door. We can speculate about the doors being modified, but we have no evidence of that. We've really no reason to think that that was true. In fact, the fact that the doors still respond to the original password suggests to me that they were certainly not changed. Because if the doors were modified after Sauron's invasion, you're probably just going to remove the password that automatically opens them, right? I mean, if my kingdom were at risk of coming under siege by Sauron and his armies, that would be probably the first alteration I'd make to the doors. To say, maybe let's disable the automatic opening feature, right? Yeah, I think I don't think that just the fact that it still automatically opens on the old password suggests to me that it has not been changed. And Matt, I agree. I certainly don't think that the door just can have its password updated every 90 days, right? I doubt that. Yeah. Anyway, and I see some of you saying that we have covered no words tonight, and that is not true. We have been talking about this third paragraph of this slide for some time now. And now let us finish the slide. What does the writing say? Asked Frodo, who was trying to decipher the inscription on the arch. Notice, by the way, that little embedded hint that Tolkien has put in the text, right? Frodo is trying to decipher the inscription on the arch. You too should try to decipher the inscription on the arch. To assist your deciphering, I've put the text there in English letters in two different languages, right? So that you can see. I thought I knew the elf letters, but I cannot read these. The words are in the elven tongue of the west of Middle-earth in the Elder Days, answered Gandalf. Which is an interesting way to describe it. The elven tongue of the west of Middle-earth in the Elder Days. It's Sindarin, is what he's saying, right? I guess that's to differentiate it from the elven tongue of the blessed realm. Right, that's what Bilbo calls it, right? When Bilbo says to Frodo at the end of chapter 1 of book 2 as they're leaving the Hall of Fire, right? And they're hearing a song in Quenya. And he says they will sing that in many songs of the Blessed Realm, many other songs of the Blessed Realm, many times tonight. Yes. So even there, you'll notice, instead of just throwing out the word, which he could do, the word Sindarin, I mean, he doesn't name the language. Instead, he roots the language in the history. Right? It does tell the reader more than Sindarin. Exactly right. That's exactly the point. What is important about the languages is not the names that the languages have been given. It's the history and the legends, right? It's the concepts you're supposed to associate with them. When you hear Quenya, you're supposed to think of Valinor. When you hear Sindarin, you're supposed to think of the west of Middle-earth in the Elder Days, right? But they do not say anything of importance to us. They say only, the doors of Durin, Lord of Moria, speak, friend, and enter. And underneath, small and faint, is written, I, Narvi, made them. Celebrimbor of Holland drew these signs. Exactly. He's defining Sindarin here. That's exactly right. So when he says they don't say anything of importance to us, the beginning, the doors of Durin, Lord of Moria, certainly, so that what is the top row, top left-hand row, right? The doors of Durin, Lord of Moria. Speak, friend, and enter. Now, I'm going to get, yeah, and of course, yes, Gandalf turns out to be quite wrong about it not being important to them. It does say, it does give one important piece of information as they're going to emphasize, that is, that it's a verbal password that will open the door. Gandalf seems to think that an unnecessary hint, basically. I don't know enough Sindarin to know the answer to this question. I'm going to guess. This is me just speculating. Gandalf, of course, is mistranslating the phrase, right? Speak, friend, and enter, or say, friend, and enter. The difference, of course, between speak and say is that one is a transitive verb and one is an intransitive verb. And it's an interesting kind of difference. I'm wondering. Bjarnason, that's what I'm wondering, whether Sindarin would make any kind of distinction. Speak can be transitive. You can say, speak the password. It's very unusual, though. Basically, what I'm trying to figure out is whether Gandalf actually made a mistake. That is to say, it does not at all say speak, friend. And like, to say that it says speak, speak is an error by Gandalf. He's simply mistranslating or he's mistaking it. Like, for instance, in some inflected languages, and this is a thing I was encountering in Greek recently, the imperative form and the present form and the future form, future indicative, present indicative, and imperative, all are exactly identical, like precisely the same. And you have to tell by context which one of those it is. Is it future indicative? Is it present indicative? Is it imperative? And I was wondering if there might be a play of that sort here, where the word as written could mean either speak or say. Because that seems to me the kind of joke that Tolkien would really enjoy. And yes, Everett, exactly. I also don't know enough Sindarin to know if there would be a declension to Melon, which would also give it away, right? That is, because, of course, say friend would be, you'd put that in the accusative, wouldn't you? Whereas speak friend, speak, comma, friend, like the way that Gandalf translates it, friend would just be, what, in like the vocative or something? Like you're just addressing them. So are the accusative and vocative are the same? Okay. Is that true? The accusative and vocative are the same? Vardandil is arguing that say friend, like say quotation marks friend, would still be vocative inside the quotes, you think? Maybe. Right. Yeah. I wonder. So the objects are marked with initial consonant when lenition. Really? Initial consonants? Oh, that Tolkien. So funky. So in fact, so if the word melon, then, as an accusative, right, so as Trifle was saying, say friend would be, so wait, hang on. You're telling me that Gandalf doesn't make the mistake, Tolkien does? So Gandalf correctly translates it? It's just that Celebrimbor was messing with him? Is that what you're... right, okay, it's literally a riddle. Okay. So it does, in fact... Okay, so say friend would be pedo velon, not pedo melon. Right. Yeah, well, that's the other thing I was wondering, Bjarnasonar. One of the hard things about... So it's very difficult. Whenever people ask me a question about Tolkien's world or stories, I always feel like in order to answer the question, you kind of have to... You always have to give a qualifier, right? Like, at what point in Tolkien's life is the answer that you're giving, right? Because he had different ideas at different points in his life, so you can give several perfectly correct answers to the same question, and it depends on when you're talking about, right? This is like even more true, or at least more complicatedly true, of his languages. So if you say, like, yes, I know Sindarin well, when exactly, right? Because he was constantly tweaking those. Yeah. So, okay. I see. So Trifle, what you're telling me is that if you actually read... But hang on a second. Isn't that an M, melon, that's in the Tengwar on the arch? So that's not... Well, again, I don't know the Moda Beleriand. Is that a V in the Moda Beleriand? Okay. Okay. right. Yikes. All right. Right. So what I'm trying to parse is where the mistake comes in. The translation mistake. I'm trying to explain Gandalf's translation mistake. Is it Gandalf's fault? Is it Celebrimbor's fault? So Trifle, you're saying that it's a riddle because... It says, speak, friend, and enter on the arch. Gandalf is not mistranslating it. So it's not that Gandalf mistranslates it. It's that he doesn't get the joke. Right? It's that he fails to see that it's a riddle. Right? Right. Celebrimbor is deliberately concealing the sentence because he's putting the word as the actual password. Okay. So if you read, and first of all, for those of you who think we're thinking about this too much, Tolkien, I believe, would disagree. Okay. Right, Merlinus, that's what I'm thinking, that he's taking it too seriously and therefore not seeing the joke a riddle. Yes, okay. So it would open if you just read it aloud. In Sindarin, right? Because again, I'm just like with the Tengwar. Is that an M? It looks like an M to me. In fact, I'm sure it's an M because it's the same as the beginning of Moria. Here, yeah, it's an M, right? So it does say Melon. So Celebrimbor wrote it ungrammatically on the gate on purpose. So is the ungrammaticality of Celebrimbor's writing meant to be a hint, therefore? Right. And JJ, you're right. Of course, we can remember our theories about not just the reproduction of this drawing by the printers from Tolkien's sketch, but the reproduction of this drawing by Frodo and Sam from their memories. But, right, okay. Okay. Okay, so basically, Bjarnasona, you're suggesting that by writing with an M, Pedo Melon, instead of Pedo Velon, which would be the proper way to if it were a direct object, right? Then that is basically, it's the sort of the equivalent, right, of quotation marks, essentially. Yeah. Yes. That one of the challenges I'm having, Eric and Bjarnason are both, and I'm not, Bjarnason, I'm not crediting you with a unique insight into this, just rather that you're explaining it to me. Eric, you say the lack of expected lenition would usually indicate a pause, either grammatical or rhetorical. Yes, except I think that most of us don't really understand the word lenition, which I believe to be the altering of the word in order to decline it, basically. But I want to make sure I'm understanding that word properly. It's not in my everyday vocabulary. Okay. Right, so Everett says, if so, how was this hard to figure out? Yes. It would be, okay. Right, thank you, Jackie, for quoting from letter 347 here. Tolkien is defending Gandalf seeming rather dense here. Tolkien also wanting to explain it by realizing what a burden of responsibility, haste, and fear he bore. Yes. So I think two things here. First of all, so Gandalf's, if we're understanding this properly, then the word melon is a little bit unusual, but grammatically it would be the same. That is, speak, friend, and enter. The word friend is addressing the reader, right? Oh, friend of mine, speak and enter, right? Or say, friend, and enter, right? In both cases, there's the whole, like, what we would indicate with punctuation, right? What we would indicate with inverted commas or quotation marks. Or regular commas, right? In either case, whether it's quotation marks or commas, the word friend is being set apart, right? And Gandalf perceives that, and he's not wrong to perceive. So it's not in that sense a mistranslation exactly. He's just not exactly really following it. Right. Normally the object would have the first letter changed, but the object here isn't a friend, but the word friend. And that's why, so like that, it indicates the kind of quotation marks here. Right. Okay. So the answer to the question, how badly does Gandalf mistranslate this phrase, is not that badly, actually. It's a very understandable mistake. And we do need to remember the pressure and the stress and the fear. And I would also, JJ, I think that you're quite right to point out how dismissive Gandalf is here. They do not say anything of importance to us, right? He translates them in a way which is potentially, at least, a correct way, right? That's a perfectly viable translation of the phrase. And in a sense, he is misled by the first half. The first half, the doors of Durin, Lord of, it's just a label. They know this. Right? So he takes the second half, he assumes that the second half of it is a similar kind of pro forma phrase, right? Which has some functionality in that it conveys the mere idea that, you know, it's a verbal password that opens the doors, right? But it's just like boilerplate, blah, 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 right? Yeah, when I say dismissive, that's distracted or rushed. That's what I mean. I think I do mean dismissive. Just in the sense of he's skimming over it quickly. Like we don't have to think that much about that part, right? It's just a label, right? A label and general instructions. He didn't realize that it was the instructions, right? Notice, and underneath, small and faint, is written, I, Narvi, made them, Celebrimbor of Holland drew these signs, right? And that's what the lower, smaller row, says, right? Narvi made them, Celebrimbor, nope, not gonna try to learn how to read the mode of Beleriand right now. Yes, I am. That's Celebrimbor of... Look at that! Ooh, unless I'm wrong, and I certainly can't be wrong, Gandalf translated doesn't say Celebrimbor of Holland. It says Celebrimbor of Eregion. See that at the beginning? That's an E-R-E. That's clearly an E-R-E at the beginning. Even though I don't know, I can see it's just from the pattern, right? Yeah, right, as it is correctly written down here. So Gandalf is translating that. He's translating Eregion to Holland because that's how he introduced it before. Right, drew these signs. Yep, yep. Okay. Yep. Cool. Yes. Okay. Anyway, so there's another place that Gandalf is translating for their benefits. And yes, Eric, that's exactly what I was building to, that it suggests that Gandalf is in more of a paraphrase mode. Yeah. Exactly. All of that seems to betray that Gandalf is assuming from the start that the answer is not going to be written on the bloody gate, right? You know, he's like, he does say people are wondering, right? Frodo's asked, what does the writing say? Right. But it seems to Gandalf like the answer to that question, that's just like a trivia question, essentially. And he tells him, right? Because, of course, if somebody within the context of a Tolkien book wants to know what strange elvish writing says, we're going to get an explanation of it, right? But yes, I do think that he is, we can see his attitude towards this. The mistake that Gandalf makes, the problem that Gandalf has, is, as he's going to say later on, it does not even occur to him that the answer is right there on the gates the whole time. He doesn't think that any of this stuff is of any importance to them. He doesn't think any of this is relevant. Yeah. Jackie, thank you for confirming our discussion of the Sindarin based on Parma Eldolambaron issue 17. Just dropping it, as Bjorning points out, just tossing that out there in the chat. Little Room Johnny thinks that Gandalf needs to cut Butterbur some slack after this. Possibly. Yeah, Silk Wescott, you're right. He kind of yada yada's the best part, doesn't he? Yeah. But fortunately, yes, Gandalf can see through a brick wall in time. All right, so guess what? We finished a slide, the slide that we did last time. So there we are. And we finished the drawing also. So that's two slides, or two half slides, that we did. And now we're back right on pass, right back on our path here. And we're going to continue with Merry's question and Gandalf's explanation next time. But yes, the way is still shut. Don't worry. I'm sure we'll open the doors before we get to session number 300. Yep, still more door in the future, no question. All right, thanks everybody for joining us. That is all for our book discussion this evening. It's field trip time. Thanks everybody for the interactive and detailed discussion today. That was excellent. Appreciate that. And we're gonna field trip now. How are you this evening, Valori?
Good to be back. Good to be back. I missed everybody.
Absolutely. Glad you're feeling better.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Yeah, no, the weather's just, his arm has grown long indeed.
Yes, it's been very difficult.
This whole, when I was reading this, like, it reminded me of the riddle about St. Ives. As I was going to St. Ives, I met a man with seven wives. Each right. wife had seven sacks, seven cats, seven kits, all that thing. And yeah, you could tell all the clever people are busy there trying to add up all of the numbers because they immediately think this is a math thing.
Right.
They've right. They already know how to solve it. They're already busy solving it. While, like, you know, mostly the people who have already heard it will know that the answer is, as I was going to St. Ives, so the answer is one.
Right, exactly.
So it's like Gandalf is already trying to add up the cats and the sacks and the kits while the hobbits are sitting there going, what was that first bit?
Right, right. Yes. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I agree. I think that that's an interesting parallel. Very cool. Yes. Yeah, it is a good comparison. It's like if you... the trick is not to get caught into thinking about it too much, right?
Or to immediately think you know how to solve it.
Right, right. What the answer... or how the answer must certainly be found. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
All right. Well, we are. Where? Hang on a second. Where are we headed today? Oh, no. Wait a second.
Stop the deck got doing on last week.
Sorry. What was that, Jurisfire?
We were at Ekad Dunan last week.
Yeah, I know that's where we ended. Okay, I think so. Let's go back to Ekad Dunan. We were gonna go down and look at the Saranan bed and everything, right?
Oh, okay.
Yes, I think today was
many fond memories of the Saranan bed.
Today was the final. Pre-instance field trip.
Oh, yeah, nice. I got back just in time.
Yes. Okay. All right, so let us... let's head back to the Burnt Tor.
Okay.
Head back to the Burnt Tor. Do you have to have a quest for Bill the Pony, or is he just hanging around?
I think clicking on Bill hanging around starts the quest.
So, like, if we theoretically, if we rode around these rocks, we could find Bill the Pony sitting there. He is part of the landscape.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, fun fact for those who haven't met me in person, I actually have Melon tattooed on my wrist.
Right.
In proper Sindarin, not proto-Sindarin. We had a couple of Myth Guardians look up the correct characters for that one.
Oh, there he is.
Yep. It's old Bill.
Noble Steed. I love his little title there.
She thinks I'm a noble steed.
Bill the noble steed. So, yeah. So, again, this is a lovely quest where you find Bill and help escort him out. And thus, as I was mentioning last time, prove the instrument of Gandalf's blessing upon Bill. Which is really quite a clever reading of the text, right? As he invokes guard and guiding upon Bill. Right? As if mm-hmm. guard and guiding is to come upon Bill from the outside, right? He doesn't just bless him with like the strength and wisdom to find the trail himself, right? Or fight off the wolves or whatever. He says that, you know, may words of guiding and guarding go, you know, be upon you. And then we come and guide him and guard him. As we lead him out through these hills, which are indeed, as you can see, crawling with wolves and wargs.
Oh, yeah.
Just as Sam was worrying. So I love it's in its way. The Bill the Pony quest is one of my very favorite. Okay, so there's the Burnt Tor right there. Is one of my favorite like book as far as like its interpretation of the text. It's not only a wonderful opportunity to kind of be a part of the story in the way that's so typical of LOTRO, where they, you know, mm-hmm. they don't change the story in order to fit you in it necessarily, but they find opportunities to involve the players in the story.
I like that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
exactly.
I think every person who read it as a kid or a horse lover is all just like, but what happened to Bill? So
right.
This is also some nice closure, I think.
Right. Okay, so
very satisfying.
So it really is. So Gandalf is going to lead them, and what they do is they strike south, right? They strike south mm-hmm. to find the Saranan, which they think is going to, oh, so sorry, good question. What is a tor? A tor is a hill with really steep sides.
Like, yeah, there's a famous hill in England called Torpenhoe Hill, which has four different words for hill in it.
Yeah, exactly. Tor is it's different. It's like a little mesa. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so if we head south, so Gandalf's plan was to head south from here where they found the wolves, and yes, steep sides and a flat top are what make a tor. And if you ask what's the difference between a tor and a mesa, I will tell you the language you're speaking primarily.
Yeah.
So his plan seemed really for simplicity as much as speed, right? Because in the wild country, he didn't know the direct way to the gates from there. So he says instead, okay, let's go. The river runs east-west, right out of Moria Gate. All we need to do is go south until we strike the river, and then we can follow the river right back up to the gates.
And some river.
Right. And here it is. Now, the riverbed of the Saranan in the game is huge, and this is something, this is fairly typical of LOTRO. Everything is kind of bigger proportionally in LOTRO. We do see some puddles here, which implies that it was really quite recently that this river was diverted.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, if you see the route that we were taking there, it's very much, I should probably go back up to the road up here. It's very much a, you know, taking the two long sides of the right triangle, right, in order to get to the gate.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the idea is that it was safer. Anyway, so what we're on right now is the old road that passed along beside it. And we've looked at this before, because we were looking at the ruins and stuff in here before and speculating about this. You know, the fun ways in which in LOTRO they have embedded into the, you know, into the ruins, into the landscape here, elements of the history of this. And so we can see this, we see not only a place where a road was leading up into in towards the mountains of Moria, which are there up in front, frowning down on us, as described in the book. But also, we can see the, you know, the ruins that show where the elves of Eregion built stuff, including Echad Dúnan, where we began up here, which is, as we were speculating, the truck stop. But the entrance, so we have a ruin at the entrance here. We will. I told people we would do this next week, so we'll wait until next week to enter in.
Okay.
We need the instance to enter in.
Oh, yeah.
When are we going to be able to... Is it... I don't. It's been so long since I've done this. Is it... Is it mostly instanced all the way through? Do you just have to have completed the quest and then you can get into the regular landscape?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay. All right. So we can explore the landscape. We just... You just need to have done the quests first.
Mm-hmm.
The old ancient legendary items quest.
Yep.
Okay. All right. So we will enter into the gates. Why do you think it's a peculiar choice to me? The water, I mean. I mean, on the one hand, it makes it more obvious that it's a dried riverbed. But instead of showing like a tiny trickle of water, they just have these big puddles. And that implies to me anyway, as I said, that it's that it's recent, that the river dried up recently or stopped running recently. But of course it wasn't recent. It was like, I mean, we know that the Watcher and the Water were at the gates when Balin was there. And we know Lotro has not forgotten about that. I mean, they include elements of that in the Moria story.
Yeah, the water's new, actually. Last time I was down here, it didn't have the puddles.
Yeah, is that part of a revised landscape?
Possibly.
So, I mean, yes, it's possible it would collect rainwater, but I would be a little bit surprised if it stayed. I mean, normally, you know, puddles that are not fed by anything else will just dry up, even if it's collecting from a fair area.
Mm.
He says, living in a house on a downslope near a pond, and an enormous percentage of whose land is covered in just such sorts of puddles.
To be fair, my neighbor's driveway has had a lake in it for most of last year.
Yeah. Well, it's true, if it rains enough, it'll stay for quite a while. We had such a rainy summer this year that one of the water features outside our house, the one we call the lagoon, stayed year-round. It almost always dries up in the summertime. But this did not, so...
Yeah, same thing with our neighbor's driveway. It's a puddle about 7 feet by like 29 feet.
Yep.
And about a good half a foot deep. And it was there all year.
Yep.
So maybe they've just had a lot of rain.
Maybe they've just had a lot of rain. Very possible. But
it's not my usual geographical historical references, but there we go, you know.
Right. It's very evocative, at least, you know, to kind of, it's this visual reminder that, you know, there was or should be water in there. And yes, I agree, Emmathorn, this would have been quite the waterfall here that we're next to. And also, of course, explains why the elves chose to make the way station right here, right? Mm-hmm. Because it would doubtless have been lovely when the Saranan was running.
Yep. Oh, JJ mentions this. The puddles could be the result of the recent snowstorm.
Right.
That drove the Fellowship this way. It is, and plus it's winter. It's winter. This could be melted ice.
It is.
It could
winter.
Have been frozen for months. Yeah.
Right. Possibly so. Possibly so. Yeah. All right. Well, brief field trip tonight. That's okay. We'll be ready to go into towards Moria next time. And when we go through these gates, we shall not be coming out again for a long time.
Say goodbye to the sunlight.
we're gonna head off and explore Moria during. So we'll see. I'll be interested to see whether we can explore the entirety of Moria in game or discuss our way through Moria faster. So we'll see.
We might have to put a lecture hall in Moria.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Anyway, It's getting late anyhow, so I'll let folks go. Thanks everybody for joining us. We'll be back again next week. We'll enter in through the outer Moria gate here in game, and we will explore the area just outside Moria, and then we will continue on towards the gates as we move forward. So thanks everybody. Thanks, Lori. Good to have you back with us again.
Happy Mardi Gras. Happy Valentine's Day. Happy Ash Wednesday. All that stuff.
Indeed. Indeed. Very good. Thanks everybody. Bye now.
Good night.